The matter of State versus AM. Can we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. We're going to try to go right through and wrap this up. I see the amount of time that folks have reserved, and I'd ask you, as we did the last counsel, to incorporate arguments that others have made. Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'd just like to reserve an opportunity for rebuttal.
That's fine.
In the event that arises.
And try to keep your voice up.
Good morning, Your Honors. The appellate panel here held that the police violated defendant's Miranda rights. To get to this result, the panel had to believe that defendant pretended to read and understand his Miranda rights for 27 seconds. Defendant pretended to read and understand the waiver provision for another 28 seconds. The defendant lied to the police when he told them that he understood the waiver provision after reading it. The defendant did not ask any questions about his alleged misunderstanding, despite previously affirming 2 minutes earlier that he would ask any questions they had about his rights. That defendant's questions asking for clarification during the interview were not indicative of whether he would have sought clarification of his Miranda rights, and that defendant requested the Spanish language Miranda form despite not being able to read Spanish. The panel's decision here eviscerates this court's guidance in SS, which requires deference to factual findings in Miranda hearings, even in instances where those findings are based on video-recorded interviews. The judge here found that defendant was given the opportunity to read the waiver provision and did, in fact, read the waiver provision. The judge also found that defendant would have voiced difficulty if he had any problem reading the waiver provision. Mere disagreement with the trial court's decision in the first instance is not a reason to overturn. There is sufficient, credible evidence in this record to support the trial court's factual findings. In fact, there is no evidence in this record suggesting that defendant did not read and understand the Miranda warnings and waiver. Just as critical, the appellate panel here also improperly relied on two rationales which it raised sua sponte that represents a dramatic sea change in the law and the current practice in our courts and have been interpreted in a manner that imposes significant practical and financial burdens on law enforcement. First, without citing to any applicable authority, without any briefing by the parties, and without any discussion of practicality or cost, the appellate panel here held that the absence of an independent translator inherently undermines a Miranda waiver obtained from a non-English-speaking suspect. Second, without citing to any applicable authority, without any briefing by the parties, and without any discussion of practicality or cost, the panel's opinion suggested that there is an inherent flaw in any transcript of a witness interview transcribed by a prosecutor's office employee or detective. State submits that these two rationales are deeply flawed. If an English-speaking police officer can administer Miranda warnings to an English-speaking defendant, then a Spanish-speaking police officer should be able to administer Miranda warnings to a Spanish-speaking defendant. Moreover, if an English language transcription by a prosecutor's office employee is not inherently suspect, then a Spanish language transcription by that same employee should not be inherently suspect. We therefore ask this court to reverse the appellate division and hold that defendant voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived his Miranda rights, that there is no inherent flaw in a Miranda waiver simply because the state uses a detective to translate during foreign language interviews, and transcripts are not suspect merely because they are transcribed by a prosecutor's office employee. With that, Your Honors, I conclude my opening statement.
Well, isn't there a need to show a requisite level of comprehension on behalf of the person being given his Miranda warnings?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
And where do you find that in this record?
So I find that principally, you know, and there are other parts of this record where I find that, but I think the best aspect of demonstrating his understanding of the Miranda rights was that he was read aloud each right from the form and then asked orally, do you understand? And the defendant said yes. And then he also read each of the rights for, I think, 27 seconds and then initialed them. Now, with respect to the waiver provision, the state concedes and the appellate division noted that that was not read aloud to defendant. But the record is absolutely crystal clear. And when you watch the transcript and you watch the video, that defendant, after having read the waiver provision, looked up nodded at the police officer. The police officer said, "Do you understand?" And he said, "I understand."
Assume for the sake of argument, just for the sake of argument, that the defendant did not understand the waiver provision because he was illiterate. Under those circumstances, would you concede that the state would not be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, intelligent, knowing, voluntary waiver?
No, Your Honor. Before I answer that question, we are absolutely contesting that he made an explicit waiver and he did understand.
I know your argument.
Sure.
You believe he read it, understood it.
And more importantly, the judge found that.
Now my hypothetical.
So implied waiver. If he didn't understand.
If you're arguing an implied waiver, then you're basically saying that the waiver language in that Miranda card is unnecessary. It's basically a vestigial organ of this Miranda card.
I'm saying it's not constitutionally required. Now, the state will...
That's why I said in the hypothetical, if it wasn't, if he didn't understand it, or now, if it wasn't even on the card, if he didn't read it aloud, if he didn't read it, it wasn't there, would you still be making the argument that you are today, that this was a valid, knowing, intelligent waiver beyond reasonable doubt?
Because he was read his Miranda rights verbally, and he acknowledged them each right. And I think on top of that, it's not just that fact, but there are other aspects of this record. So, before he was read his Miranda rights in Spanish, he told Detective Lucas that he would ask any questions that he had about his rights. He then elected to answer the questions from the police officers here without any reluctance or cajoling. There was absolutely no suggestion that any hesitancy on his part. And I think, very importantly, and the judge relied on this with respect to the explicit waiver, but I think it applies equally to an implied waiver argument, he had no problem telling the detectives when he didn't understand something later in the interview. I counted, and I stopped counting, because I reached 7 times during the course of the interview where he either indicated or he said, "I don't understand," because there were certain questions posed to him in English. He didn't understand. He looked at Detective Ramos here as the translator and say and indicate that he didn't understand, and then it would be translated for him. So this, when this defendant didn't understand something, he had no problem expressing that to the police. So I think there is a strong implied waiver argument here. But, as you can tell from our briefs, we focus very hard on the explicit waiver because it is just so, I think it's the facts are so clear on that, and the trial court's findings should definitely be given deference in this case, because there is, if this isn't substantial credible evidence, it's hard to imagine what would be.
Is your answer to Justice Alvin's question, if you do the first 5 points on this waiver form properly, if you read them aloud, if you get the answer, if you get the initial, then it doesn't matter whether there's even a waiver section altogether?
So I think there is an implied waiver argument. I'm not saying that, it would always be fact sensitive. And what you'd have to say is, is it beyond reasonable doubt that the suspect waived his Miranda rights? And I think this, usually it's done explicitly. It can be done implicitly. And I think so if he's read his Miranda rights and he understands them, and then the totality of the circumstances suggests that he did impliedly waive his Miranda rights, then I don't think you have to, we don't have to always read and have an explicit waiver to have a defendant waive his Miranda rights. It can be an implicit waiver.
Don't you think that if a police officer is not reading something aloud and he's asking a person to read a provision, he should ask him whether or not he's capable of reading that, whether he understands, or at least have him read it allowed, given the level of illiteracy, even in our state, the social science statistics suggest 17%. That's across the board and much higher level among underserved communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what he did ask in this case, immediately after the suspect and the defendant read the waiver provision, he said, "Do you understand?" And the suspect said yes. So he did. Yes. That is, and I submit, Your Honor, that's better than
he just said. He said, "Do you understand?" And the social science, based upon shaming, people who cannot read are reluctant to admit to anyone that they're not capable of reading, that they're illiterate.
So I
social science. I mean, even if there was no social science, you would be able to intuit this, that a person would not want to be shamed into expressing that he or she is illiterate, is incapable of reading.
And I understand that, and certainly, you know, I think Your Honor is right. You don't need social science to know that certain individuals in certain circumstances would feel shame in admitting illiteracy. But the question posed by the detective here didn't ask him to say he couldn't read. It asked him whether he understood, and he said yes. He could have answered that question and said, no, I don't understand, without admitting any illiteracy. And, you know, I am literate. You know, I am a lawyer. I am capable, and I do routinely ask, even when I'm reading legal documents, I don't understand. There's no shame in that. I'm not admitting illiteracy. I'm just asking for clarification about something. So he was perfectly capable. And I think also, what a ruse this was from this particular defendant, if my colleagues over here are correct. To read the waiver, the Miranda rights for 27 seconds, to read the waiver provision for 28 seconds, to then tell them that you can read, to ask questions later, to
he never said he could read.
What's that?
He never said he could read, did he?
He said he understood something after reading it.
Yes, when asked if he understood.
Yes. And so if in fact we had asked him the question, well, can you read it, and then just handed him the provision, that's actually a worse question, because that would require him
to
say, I'm illiterate.
He understood. Give us the context. He just said, he had him looking at it, and then he said, do you understand?
Yeah, so he showed, I think when you look at, and it's crystal clear, when you look at the video and you look at the transcript, he's given the waiver, he's shown the waiver portion of the form. He looks down and he reads it for, it's actually 40 seconds, but he spends 12 of those seconds turning off his cell phone. And then he looks up from the provision and he nods his head before anything is said, and the detective says, do you understand? And he says, yes. So clearly he's indicating he understands, clearly he's indicating that he can read, and that's on top of the fact that he previously had also taken 27
seconds
to read.
He didn't say, do you understand? And then announce something. He just said, "Do you understand?"
Yes, and then he signed the.
Because the officer told him to sign. He said, "Put your signature there and put." Correct.
So the sequencing is: the officer said, after he looked up and said and nodded his head yes after reading the waiver provision, and after telling the officer that he understood, the officer did say, "Write your name here completely." Then he wrote his name in to, like, there's a line for I, so-and-so, you know, acknowledge that. So he wrote his name in. Then he gave it back to the detective. And then the detective looked at, seeing that he'd already put his name into the space for the waiver provision, detective gave it back to him and said, you have to sign this here as well, pointing to, because there was a signature line in addition to the line where you just write in your name. So by the time he said, you have to, sign this, he'd already signed the on the line.
So, you know, the arguments of your counsel are that we've said in Prussia and other cases that a waiver has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that your argument, the one that you're advancing today, is shifting the burden to them. Like, when you say, do you understand, that he has to somehow admit that he's illiterate, whereas they're saying that you should have been asking the necessary questions to ensure that he was literate enough to understand what he was reading. How do you respond to that?
All we're asking for is for this court to apply a beyond a reasonable doubt standard and to defer to the factual findings, importantly, defer to the factual findings of the trial judge. Now, that can take many forms. Your Honor points at, yes, it's true, they could have read aloud to him the waiver provision, but they didn't. So the question is on this existing record, Is there proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he read and understood? And I think if defendant says he can read it, if he does, if he looks like he's reading it, if he takes his time to read the rights as well,
looking down. Whether he's reading, no one can say. Do you agree with that? How do I know a person who's looking down at a piece of paper, who's illiterate, or even if he's literate, how do I know he's reading?
Your Honor, I think given the totality of the circumstances, it was a fair finding for the judge to find that he was reading and that there's more than substantial credible evidence in this record to support it.
Even if he had a PhD, how would you know he's reading? He's looking down. I mean,
yes,
he can't read
yes.
his mind. How would we ever know that anyone is reading?
And Your Honor makes a good point. And another point is that even it's read out loud to him and he says he understands.
How do we know he's listening?
How do we know he's listening? How do we know? At some point, we have to defer to the factual findings of the trial judge when there is substantial but credible evidence in the record. And Your Honor, there is not a shred of evidence that I can point out, and I don't believe I saw any in the briefs, that says he could not read. There's not a single shred of evidence that says he can't. So I think that is part of the analysis as well. Not that we're burden shifting, but we're saying, I have all this evidence of him affirming that he can read, all this evidence of him actually looking like he's physically reading it, his eyes are trained on it, for, by the way, the appropriate amount of time. If you read those provisions yourself, 27 and 28 seconds is an appropriate amount of time that you would take to read that.
In your experience, is this the typical fashion in which rights are administered with no one reading aloud the waiver section?
I have seen many cases where they do that, where the waiver provision is given to them for them to sign without. And sometimes I suppose they could read it aloud.
Is there anything in the training in Bergen County that directs officers to approach it one way or the other? I'm not suggesting there's a binding rule as a result, but what
sure.
is the practice?
So candidly, Your Honor, after AM, we put out a directive that says you should read the waiver provision to avoid this problem in the future. I really hope that that wouldn't inure to our detriment in this case, because you know I think we still have to evaluate. You know, there's best practices, and then there's constitutional requirements, and there's
who is it
problems.
Under that guide? Who is reading? Is it the defendant or is it the officer reading aloud?
It would be, I believe our question is that the officer, I believe our directive is that the officer is reading out loud.
And perhaps the Attorney General can tell us policies elsewhere.
Yes. And I should know the answer to that question. I don't, it might be that the defendant has, but I believe that it's the officer.
Questions, anyone?
And I just want to point out to you
the points in the concurrence.
Yes. And I know usually when you know you ask me without me to add, I run to my chair. But I just want to point out that we have not, you know, even though we haven't really discussed the issue of sort of the inherent flaw of a transcript produced by a prosecutor's office employee in particular, and certainly also the argument about you know an independent requirement for an interpreter to be in the room. You know, the state's position is that, you know, you don't need a quote-unquote independent interpreter to be in the room.
What is the process? I was looking for that in the record here, but what is the process if you have a transcriber who is not a certified court reporter, someone who works in the prosecutor's office, transcribes it, there's a translation going on as part of that transcription into English?
Yes.
What happens when a defendant says, that's not what I said?
So typically what would happen is that it would be worked out by the parties. They would basically agree to sort of what the appropriate translation, and that happens routinely.
I was going to say, it must be a common situation, because obviously not every translator would create the same English.
Yes. I mean, in fact, and I should point out, AOC interpreters, the master interpreters, the best interpreters that we have, they only have to be 80% accurate. That's in the Language Services Guide, the AOC directive.
So when there's a question, typically what happens is someone makes a request to settle the record so that everyone can agree what the record is, correct? Even with respect to a tape like this, if there are questions about it.
So what's the process?
Yeah.
So the process would be, so typically in Bergen County, where things are processed, the parties would come to an agreement. To the extent that there was a disagreement, in past cases, they've been able to present the fact finders with testimony from each side saying, and usually it's very narrow.
Two transcripts can sometimes come in.
Yes, and I would commend Your Honors to a Commonwealth v. Portillo, which is a Supreme Judicial Court case in Massachusetts, which outlines this very process, and that's a process followed by many.
Do you agree that when the state submits a transcript of a confession, that the person who does the translation should be certifying the accuracy of the transcript?
I think if defendant objects, That should certainly happen. If defendant objects, that should certainly happen. And
why wouldn't that occur as a matter of course? Is that too difficult a burden on the prosecutor?
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's not. And what routinely actually happens here is the officer who did the translating is the person who, because he's in the room or she's in the room, and they are going to sign off ultimately on the transcript. And so they are really the person who sort of has the final editorial review, and they're going to also testify. So like in this particular case, Detective Ramos said, I reviewed it, it's accurate to the best of my knowledge, and he, of course, is there for cross-examination to the extent that it's necessary at the 104 hearing. Now, ideally, you'd work this out beforehand. You'd have sort of a conversation about which particular points.
But you employed Mosquera as well, didn't you?
Yes.
So, I mean, Mosquera and Ramos conflicted.
Ramos said that he corrected Mosquera as to a couple, I think he just said a few corrections in the record. And then routinely, in any language, this isn't limited. There's always going to be a difference about it.
And this is lost evidence. It's not like this happens without the cameras rolling and at least audio taping. You do have what the person said in the foreign language recorded, so that if there really is a major issue, you could even have potentially translators testify before the court if it came to that.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the critical difference here about this kind of evidence versus live evidence. You know, there's an insistence on impartiality, and because the judiciary is providing the interpreters in a case or hearing, and that's a live hearing. There's not really an ability to dispute it on the fly. Whereas in these cases, in almost all cases, really at this point, there's a requirement that custodial statements are recorded for certain cases. Practically speaking, Your Honor, even though that requirement applies to certain crimes, usually first and second degree crimes, any station house recording will always be recorded, because if you don't, the question on cross-examination is going to be, why didn't you record this? Like, the law didn't require me to, but you could have. We did. It's going to look bad, obviously, and plus there's benefits to the police recording anything that they can to ward off any arguments with an actual record. So that's a long way of saying, as a practical matter, most station house recordings, all, if not all, are in fact recorded. Most station house interviews are recorded.
So if there were an issue with respect to a dialect or the meaning of a word in a particular region of the world, you have a record of what the word was, and you'd be able to at least have argument as to what the English translation of that word
would be. Yes, an opportunity to probably be better than the sort of on-the-fly interpretation that the AOC only does at 80%, guaranteed 80% accuracy. And also, that's the same provision says that if there's not a master interpreter available, you can go down to as low as 55% accuracy with respect to the on the left. So on live interpretations. So yes, there is a record here for both sides.
You could get explain that to me.
It's 1.31 in the language.
You go back to. Are you suggesting that 55% accuracy would be acceptable for a statement that the state is introducing as a confession? Is that what you're not suggesting that, are you?
No. Well, I'm suggesting that evidently is acceptable for AOC interpreters during trial. And I can look at it right here. AOC condition, it's page 13 of the Language Services Guide, standard 1.3.1. AOC conditionally approved interpreters failed the court interpreting oral performance exam score below 70%, but tested 50% accuracy or higher in each part of the exam with an overall average of 55%. Conditionally approved interpreters are allowed to work.
I hear what you're saying, and of course we're interpreting the Constitution. You wouldn't be suggesting that a confession that is 50% accurate would be constitutionally acceptable, would you?
No, but what I am suggesting is that merely being impartial isn't a guarantee that the accuracy is going to be perfect either, and the best tool in the context that we're discussing is to have an adversarial process determine that.
Mr. Kennedy, I know that the issue came up somewhat sua sponte, but with regard to the first issue that you were addressing,
yes.
Are you aware if Bergen County or the state generally, and I'll ask the Attorney General this question as well, maintains any statistics about the percentage rate of interrogated suspects waiving their Miranda rights generally versus the rate of waiver by people who are being given their rights through an interpreter?
I don't. I'm not aware. I, I can say I doubt those statistics are kept, but I don't know. I'm sorry, Aaron.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Ms. Schuster.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Like the state, the Attorney General agrees that there's enough here for an explicit waiver. But recognizing this Court's concerns about the reading piece and understanding that that is a very real reality for a certain percentage of the population, this is also a really, the Attorney General feels strongly that there's enough here for an implicit waiver also. And the implicit waiver doctrine in New Jersey is over 50 years old. It goes back to Kremens. And in Kremens, the defendant was told the four Miranda rights and then afterwards said, I'll tell you. There was no waiver language there. And this waiver language that the appellate division focused on, it's not constitutionally required. And waiver language, quite frankly, even the term waiver can be very confusing for people using the word waiver. Nobody even knows what that means.
Have you read the Adelis case?
I'm sorry?
Never mind.
Sorry, inside baseball.
Inside joke.
Go ahead.
Should have been in the room.
If you're talking about sports, I'm completely lost.
No.
So the point is, it's just that this waiver language is just, it's not constitutionally required. It never has been. Miranda has four rights. In fact, language that has become part and parcel of what is on Miranda cards in New Jersey is very often a fifth right, that you can invoke these rights at any time. And that is, of course, what the law is, but Miranda doesn't even require that additional information be added. And it was added in this particular time, and it's so important, I think, it's an important thing to let defendants know, because the point is you can give them waiver language afterwards, and you can say, sign here, or you can sign here, and the bottom line is whether or not they sign their name on that form in that moment, or they say, are you willing to talk to me after you give the rights, and they say, yes, I'm willing to talk to you, 1 second later, they can say, actually, I'm not willing to talk to you. So I think it's far more compelling here that language of, you can change your mind at any time, that kind of language is far more informative for a particular suspect than this so-called waiver language that comes after. These forms are really, would be better almost referred to as acknowledgments of rights forms, because you're not really waiving anything forever and for always. You can always invoke your rights. And here...
Are you arguing that this language is unnecessary?
It's unnecessary in the sense that it's, from a constitutional perspective, it's unnecessary. Miranda doesn't require this language. This court has never required this language. This language...
So you're saying if it were not read at all, this would be a perfectly fine confession. Is that
yes,
your position?
Like the same thing happened in Kremens, where the defendant was told, the officer testified, I told him he had the right to remain silent. Anything he said could be used against him. He had the right to have an attorney. The attorney could be present at any time. He was questioned, and if he didn't have the money to obtain the attorney, the court would furnish him one. And then immediately thereafter, the defendant said, I'll tell you. So in that case, this court held that the defendant had waived his rights.
So Kremens was 1968. The actual interrogation preceded Miranda. Preceded the Miranda decision, the interrogation. And at the time, our jurisprudence didn't require waivers beyond a reasonable doubt. We've come a long way since Kremens. No?
This court has come a long way since Kremens, but in doing so has recognized Burris, this court recognized, in Kennedy, this court recognized, cited Butler favorably, which talks about how in North Carolina versus Butler, the court said an express written or oral statement of waiver of the right to remain silent is usually strong proof of the validity of a waiver, but it's not inevitably either necessary or sufficient to establish a waiver. It's always been, and this court has always looked at the totality of the circumstances, because the bottom line is an officer could read all of the rights, and the defendant could say, yes, 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 I understand, I understand, I understand, and then goes on to have a completely non-responsive interrogation, we don't say, well, how wonderful that you read the waiver language. You gave a knowing and voluntary waiver. We say, no, you talked about going to the fish market when we asked you how old you are. You're clearly just saying yes, 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 and you're not understanding, and this is beyond your comprehension. And so we don't, just because somebody said yes to all of the rights, we look at the totality of the circumstances. That's always been this court's law. As the law has developed, this court has continued to point to the federal law and to recognize that. Recently in Burgess versus Tompkins, the United States Supreme Court reaffirmed the implied waiver doctrine, but that wasn't a new doctrine. That was, you know, reaffirming what had always been in Butler, that and as this court even before that had recognized, that you look at the totality of the circumstances. That's the appropriate analysis. And looking at the totality of the circumstances here, there was an implied waiver. And so, that
one benefit of the waiver language that is included and is pretty standard in waiver forms, rights forms, is it helps ensure that the defendant understands and knows, and it helps the state be able to demonstrate its burden at the hearing itself. With that in mind, is there any guidance that the state, that the Attorney General provides with regard to the reading of the waiver section, the acknowledgement section?
No, the Attorney General, I looked into this after Judge Fuentes wrote his concurrence and asked around, and the Attorney General made the decision after, I'm going to say, Mejia came out. There was a lot of talk, and there was a lot of things going back, that they were not going to issue mandatory statewide Miranda cards. That those cards, that to the extent that this was a responsibility that was going to be left up to the prosecutors and the local municipalities. And the Attorney General has not pushed down guidance with that respect. And this is very much in line with what Justice Ginsburg said in Florida versus Powell, is that the most important thing is that the message is conveyed. And even though Justice Ginsburg recognized that the FBI, for instance, had exemplary warnings, that of constitutional imperative, that it was more important to look at whether the meaning was translated. Was conveyed. And so even if there's a difference in the certain words that are used, that going back to whether or not the meaning of those four rights was conveyed is the key requirement, the key mandate of Miranda. And again, just going through, watching the video and going through the transcript, it's, again, under the totality of the circumstances, you know, the judge's findings are certainly supported by substantial credible evidence in the record. One of the things that is nice about this interrogation is that when the defendant goes in and sits down, it's calm, no one has raised voices, so that would prevent someone from being able to really listen and understand. Sometimes when people get very upset, they have trouble hearing and appreciating. This whole process at the outset was very calm. And initially, the officer who's speaking English explains, doesn't try to undercut the Miranda warnings at all and say, oh, these are just this thing that we do here, this is just a formality, goes through and says that these are the guidelines of us talking to each other. They're going to tell you what your rights are, that you have the right to attorney, and speaking with us is voluntary. And he says, okay, and he says that he understands that. And then Officer Ramos goes through each right and pauses and says, do you understand?
For the first four. So the court said this, and I'm going to ask you this question because your adversaries are saying that this is a burden shift. The court said if defendant had any problems reading the waiver portion of the form written in Spanish as he had requested, it's clear to this court that he would have with such difficulty. And they're saying that that's a burden shift. You had the burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, of showing a knowing and voluntary waiver that he understood. How do you respond to that?
I think that it was more of an observation based on comments based on the interrogation. On DA 125, which is page 7 of the audio statement, when they're asking when he says, do you understand? And he goes, yeah, I understand, but sometimes I cannot understand. So at the beginning, he flagged that he's going to make clear when he understands something and when he doesn't. So everything that's just been read to him, he reconfirms that all that stuff that you just said, that stuff I understand. Sometimes I don't understand, but that stuff I understood. So this is after he said, I understand to the initial, I'm going to tell you, which is that it's voluntary, you have a right to an attorney. And then he again says that he understands each of the individual rights. He says he understands after the waiver portion. But even if we were to assume that he can't read and that the form is shown to him and he said, this is what I just read you, and we cut out the part, he doesn't go through it. There's the cell phone and the transcript. It's written together where he talks about the cell phone, and then it goes right into where he says, I understand. But there's a huge gap of air, and that's where those 27 or 28 seconds are, where he's looking at the form. So even if we assume that he didn't read that, what we have there is we have him looking at the form where he was said, all of those things that I just told you are on this form. And he looks at it, and he looks at it intently and puts his name on it, and he says, I understand. So again, even without the waiver, that he's saying he understands that these forms set forth his rights. And then again, just the next page, this is where again he's like, yes, I understand, but sometimes I can't understand. But everything you just read me, I understood. So he keeps saying that he's understanding that. And then the judge correctly noted that later on, or as Mr. Kennedy pointed out, he points out where he struggles with something. And so I think when the judge was making the comment, it wasn't a burden-shifting thing. He was looking at this point that the defendant had made the comment that sometimes he doesn't understand and will let him know, and then in fact he did. And so I think the judge was making the inference that likely that would have been the case if he couldn't read or if he couldn't understand, that he would have said something. But and I think that that's a fair inference.
He actually is very quick on the video, and obviously the transcript too, but I think the video is really critical here. He's very quick to acknowledge his limitations in English. There's no hesitancy at all when he's asked about the language issue that he really wants somebody translating.
Yes,
he says
exactly.
That, and he says, that, and he's not, doesn't seem embarrassed in any way, nor should he be, to say, I have some difficulty. I don't always understand.
Right, and the mere fact that someone speaks a foreign language and maybe doesn't speak English or speak English well does not speak to their intellectual ability at all.
But that colloquy wasn't with Officer Ramos, was it? It was with the detective Bori, I think, or Lucas. I mean, the question is, are you okay with me speaking to you like this? Do you want me to go through this? Or with Officer Ramos in Spanish? And he says, in Spanish. And then he says, and do you understand me? This is the English-speaking detective saying, do you understand me? Yeah, I understand, but sometimes I cannot understand.
Right.
He doesn't understand the English. It's not the Spanish that he's not understanding, it's the English. So that colloquy has nothing to do with the waiver of rights.
I'm not... It only goes to, I only pointed it out to point out where I think the judge was getting from that this defendant would have spoken up if he didn't understand something. That doesn't, that's not dispositive of, that there wasn't a burden shifting, that he was looking, there were various different things that the judge could point to that were evidence of the fact that the defendant would speak up when he had trouble understanding something. The waiver piece is very well satisfied by the four rights being read aloud in Spanish, so that even if this defendant were illiterate, it was read to him in Spanish. He had, and as the judge correctly found, and found as a factual matter, that this defendant did not have any problem understanding going back and forth with the Spanish-speaking officer, who he also found, as a matter of fact, that he was fluent. And this is his testimony on the stand about his fluency and how he grew up and his language and his background. That to find that he was fluent and had no problem communicating, and that there was a meeting of minds between the defendant. I mean, those are factual findings that are entitled to deference.
On factual findings, the judge also, in his written opinion, said that the defendant stopped the officers on multiple occasions to ask questions, repeatedly acknowledging his comprehension of the process and correcting the officers when they misunderstand what he has said. And your adversaries have said that never happened. And they said, because that never happened, we shouldn't be showing any deference to the factual findings of the judge. So the first question is that correct? What the judge said, is that correct? I'm looking at page 12, the bottom of his opinion.
Right, no, I understand.
Because they're saying that ain't so.
Well, I mean, as the testimony goes on 9, and, I mean, they keep going back and forth where
no,
Ramos
and they're
is clarifying.
They're talking about the rights portion. Where
oh, with
they
the
said,
rights
do you have
portion?
Right, you know, you have a right to an attorney. I understand. And this is suggesting, the judges, that he was stopping the officers at acknowledging his comprehension of the process and correcting the officers when they misunderstood what he has said. I didn't read the first part of the sentence because it seems to be
right. I think,
hooked into the
rights. I think what's happening is that the judge is likely referring to the portion where the defendant said that he's most comfortable in Spanish and then says that he understands sometimes, then he doesn't, and he's making sure that he gets the rights. I think the judge is doing something I think the judge is conflating the waiver portion with the statement that followed, and I don't think that just because analytically he's conflating those two things in the way that he wrote that sentence, that cuts against the ability of this court to find that the judge's factual findings are correct. I mean, this court has routinely also found that, you know, it's sort of like you can believe that you can take things, you know, the jury charge, you can believe some, you can believe all. It's like that kind of an analysis. I mean, but here I think the judge's findings are supported, that the defendant throughout the entire encounter was that there was a meeting of minds, and that when there wasn't, that there was clarification that happened.
Is it fair to say overall that to the extent that the defendant, there was pushback from the defendant, it is when the officers were talking about the actual alleged encounter with the child, and the defendant was willing to agree with some aspects of what they were saying he did, and obviously came out with some level of acknowledgement, but on some things he would push back and say no, that didn't happen. When they were quoting, for example, the alleged victim's statement, he disagreed with some of that. I couldn't find pushback from the defendant other than in the substantive discussion that they were actually having about the allegations of the victim. See what I'm saying?
Yes.
I don't see any pushback in the whole prefatory section where he was Mirandized.
Right. I think the only explanation is post giving the warnings, when he flagged that he very much wanted to continue in Spanish and said, I understand you, but basically I don't want to continue to go further with you in English. I want it in Spanish because I don't always understand in English. So I understand what you've said so far, but I'm going to push back on this, like, stop talking to me in English because I want to talk to you in Spanish. And I think that could be fairly characterized as pushback, that he's insisting. And I think to the extent that you want to read that as part of the initial colloquy around the rights, that could be fairly seen that way.
I think we understand your position. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes. With respect to having a neutral interrogator in the room, the Attorney General feels strongly that that is not particularly feasible, but in all situations, but also that there's no that there's no real reason to have that happen. The bottom line is, once a knowing and voluntary waiver happens, that part after, that interrogation, I mean, in a perfect world, you'll have someone who's fluent speaking with a suspect, because it helps the interrogation move forward. It helps it move quickly. It helps it move seamlessly. But quite frankly, if someone is able to convey the Miranda warnings, they say, I took some Mandarin in school, and I am capable of communicating Miranda warnings, because we had a whole unit on that. We spent a lot of time doing that, and I'm the Miranda warning expert in Mandarin for whatever reason, and came up and could sufficiently, and everyone felt comfortable that the rights were communicated. and then afterwards started to talk to the person and then realized that they were completely out of their depth and the person was talking really fast and they had trouble following. And the person got really frustrated, and this is all recorded, and said, "You're a complete... I'm not able to communicate with you. This is so frustrating. Lucky for me, you don't speak Mandarin that well, because you'll never know then that I murdered so-and-so and I buried their body." The fact that the person is not the best interrogator or the best translator, and somebody winds up saying something and they're not fluent, they're not, their rights, because they've been given their Miranda warnings and they're told that they don't have to say anything, the fact that they then talk to somebody who doesn't communicate with them as well as it would be ideal, that doesn't cut against their due process rights. It doesn't cut against their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. It does. There's no constitutional need to have somebody who can perfectly translate in real time, especially particularly when something is captured on tape, because it can be reviewed later to see what happened. And then again, it may go to whether or not the weight of what goes on, or if there was a miscommunication, but it's not going to go to the admissibility. It's not going to violate somebody's rights. So,
good.
Okay, that's where we are on the interrogation. And also just to note that the extent there's any language issues, though, the counties across the state do make an effort when they don't have someone who speaks the language to reach out to their sister counties, and to the New York Police Department has been very helpful. So there is generally an effort to try to get somebody who can communicate with a suspect, a criminal suspect. And then with respect to translations, to certified translations, what happened here is very similar to a State versus Michaels kind of thing, where you have an independent review of the translation. And so although it may have been better if Ms. Mosquera had certified the translation, here you have somebody who under oath testifies that they reviewed it. They're subject to credibility findings. They were also this is an officer who actually translated that waiver language in front of the judge in real time. So all of those factual findings that this is somebody who's fluent and who's translating, that transcript is an appropriate transcript, a correct transcript, that really should be good enough to have it be admissible here. And to the extent that a party disputes something, that's when there should be a battle over the transcript, not just as a matter of course, because the bottom line is the state can pay for all sorts of certified transcripts, and at the end of the day, the defendant does not forfeit his right because the state shows up with a certified transcript. There will continue to be disputes over certain areas, and that's where the cost and the money should be spent, the effort should be spent, on those areas of dispute, not as a general matter of course, taking something, just forcing the state to incur unnecessary costs when there's no dispute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Neary.
Thank you, Chief. Chief, I understand, of course, that the court may have obligations under the Constitution to the separation of powers today, so I'll address myself hopefully quickly. I reserve some time. I will waive most of that except for two observations. One's personal. This is the first time in a long time that I have been in this room where I'm the only Neary. So I would only suggest that. I only hope that I can serve the name as well as my predecessor who served this court so well for so long.
No relation, as we understand.
Well, no, we're not. We're from two different counties in Ireland, so we've had that discussion. But here's my position on behalf of the defendant, A.M. I understand that there are two distinct positions within the opinion. One is the three-judge panel where the court found clearly, three separate judges found clearly that there was an insufficient waiver and therefore Mr. A.M. should not have that confession admitted. There's a second, of course, the Fuentes concurrence, where Judge Fuentes recognizes the arc, so to speak, of the development of the necessity and the importance of language. He wrote an opinion in 1996 when he was on the Superior Court in Hudson County about translators in the Bayonne Municipal Court. It's cited in the concurrence, where he recognized the importance. They didn't have translators in the Bayonne Court for a Spanish-speaking DWI defendant. He recognized 20-some-odd years ago its importance. His concurrence recognizes that importance and I think tries to follow the arc of Mejia through Marquez of the importance when 85%, we're just talking about Spanish, 85% of the translations by the AOC have to do with Spanish. Right? It's important that we recognize that particular language. Now, to deal with why I believe that the majority opinion, three separate judges, have found that, in fact, that there was not a knowing or voluntary or intelligent waiver. Take a look. And it was almost, I don't want to use the term like a circus, but what was the role of Detective Ramos? Was he the interpreter? Was he the interrogator? And that continued through the course of the 104 hearing. Remember, a 104 hearing is a hearing where there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, where the rules of evidence are to apply. So Ramos comes in and testifies with first regard to his rather the paucity of his own expertise that was exposed. But when you get to folly, that in the first 5 minutes or five pages, they talk about, Lucas says, these are guidelines, okay? That then when AM reads this, finally think about you where he's shown it, 45 seconds or the amount of time that my dear brother says it took, okay? Who knows that he's reading? Who knows that he's reading, that he's looking down? And as Justice Albert said, you could be pretty shy. You'd be embarrassed about that. But all they had to do was read him that statement. That's all they had to do, all right? And then the next thing they said, well, go ahead and sign it. So the issue isn't, did he waive? Of course he waived. He spoke to them. But the issue really comes, did he know what he was doing? Did he do it intelligently? And did he do it voluntarily? And when you look at the majority decision, the three judges, they actually analyze, fully recognizing the due deference necessary for the trial court in SS, fully recognizing that. The three-judge panel clearly goes over the deficiencies in this hearing. And in fact, it's narrow in one sense. It's narrow that they find that AM did not knowingly, intelligently, or voluntarily waive those particular rights. And if you just look at, when I use the word folly, that Ramos was paraphrasing. Now, my brother and sister suggest that is irrelevant in their pleadings. But I think it would be a part of the fact-finding that the trial court would have to decide whether or not that simple paraphrase was in any way affected the quality of evidence. Because that's what we're talking about, the quality of evidence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, there is some suggestion that, another one, Judge Guida, was that his phrase that, if the defendant had a problem, he otherwise would have raised it himself.
Before we get to that, mm-hmm. can we come back to the colloquy?
Sure.
The administering of the rights here.
Sure.
Because a critical question that you've identified is, did the defendant understand? There's no question it could have been done better. It could have been read aloud by either side in a way that would remove doubts here. We have the defendant, after it appears that he's reading for a period of time, being asked, do you understand? And he responds, yes. Are you asking us to assume that that's not correct, that we should not take him at his word? Is that inevitably part of your argument?
Chief, what does it, respectfully, what are we asking that he understands? What did they mean that he understands?
Look at it in context. The video shows he's given the form, he's directed, he spends time reviewing the language on the form, and then is asked, do you understand? So in context, he then says, yes. Are you asking us to ignore that?
I don't think it rises itself to the level of what would be an implicit waiver, because that's the only thing it would be. It would have to be implicit. That fact that he said, I understand, we don't know what, in fact, he says he understands.
Well, what else could it be a reference to, based on the context of the video?
So long as he understands them. But the next question has to be, so as a result of understanding, my kind of formalized, but as a result of understanding, do you wish to speak to us? Or something to that nature. We are left with speculation that the whole discussion is, as we try to glean through the transcript and the tape, that in fact this is what in fact he means. Separate apart from, it would be so easy to simply read it. But beyond that, there has to be a recognition that this non-speaking defendant has to be afforded the opportunity to express in his language clearly.
Should that be on in English also? For people who only speak English, should that be done? Because we don't know whether they're reading or not, so that should that be done for them also?
See, Justice, I think that the fact that it's in another language complicates the analysis with regard to implicit. I think it's a lot easier for us to say implicitly that somebody understands.
If someone was reading in English and it was their only language, and then you said, do you understand? You don't know if he read it or not. You don't know if he was perhaps shy and didn't want to admit that he was illiterate. We'll never know. So should that apply in English or in any language?
I think, while the context of this particular case is Spanish.
Should that be the rule now for everyone, that you have to ask them questions to ensure that they actually did read what they said they were reading or appear that they were reading?
I think it's, if the roundabout answer is, I think it's a little bit easier to infer, but it would not be a bad rulemaking policy by this court to
Why
have
would it be easier to infer in another language? We don't know if they're reading it. We don't know if they know how to read. We don't know if they're telling the truth. So why is it that Spanish is treated differently?
Well, because the trial court, the lawyers.
I just want to know what your rule is and why you believe that. If it's in English, we can assume that the person read it, knew what they were reading, and that's where you have to go no further. But if it's in Spanish, then you perhaps assume that the presumption that they didn't understand it, that they didn't want to tell you, that they're illiterate, and then we have to go further. I'd like to know where the distinction comes in your rule.
I think the literacy issue is across the board.
Okay.
That, in fact, it would be for the notion of an explicit waiver, that you would have that ability. So how hard is it to read, respectfully? Is it, do you understand, to read it to them, or have the individual read it themselves?
Well, then reading it would be a different issue then. But if they read it themselves, we would never be sure, regardless of what language it is. We don't know if they understood it. We don't know, should then we go into a level of education, that type of thing, or how far does the rule go to so that we can make a determination that they knew what they were reading?
Without avoiding the question, I could say that it should apply no matter what the language and what the literacy. But I know that my brother has addressed that issue and will speak to that issue. If you can allow me to defer at the appropriate
Absolutely.
Time,
The additional question that if I wrote it down correctly, is that obviously he was asked if he understood. Answer yes. And then the question that you suggest is, so as a result of understanding, do you want to speak with us? What does that add? As a result of understanding, do you want to speak with us? Because he's just gotten the substantive Miranda warnings as to which indicate he has the right not to speak with them. And he says he understood. And so now we insist that he make a connection between understanding and does he want to speak? You could then say, well, that's not enough. You should say, when you said you understood, what is it you understand? You could go on ad infinitum with additional questions.
I don't think, Justice, that they even cross that threshold, the simplest of thresholds in this situation. You have to be able to waive any right. When we go through a plea colloquy, we take long periods of time in the trial court to ask whether the knowing and intelligent waiver of all these constitutional rights. So we take that particular time.
Right.
Now, to have a minimal requirement.
But you've already have the question asked here, do you understand? And you get an affirmative answer. And you're I think what you're telling us is to require the next question, which is, so as a result of understanding, do you want to speak with us?
What
does that add that do you understand doesn't do for us?
I don't think we have to add, I don't think it has to be that strict and that formal, although it would make sense, would clear this question up very, very easily. But back to the question I asked the chief when I said, what is he understanding? What is he understanding?
You could, there really is no serious, if someone is, is embarrassed about a lack of understanding, either literacy issues, language issues, some combination, and is intent on hiding the difficulty that he or she is having, there, I would suggest that there are no questions that will ever get to the point where that person will acknowledge that there's an issue.
But at least you would have the question framed for the individual, that the fact finder, you know, and burden of proof being very high in a 104 hearing on the admissibility of on a Miranda violation, at least the fact finder would have the assurance that they could rely upon, said it was read to him. So then maybe then the burden shifts, the defendant said, no, I really didn't understand. But from this record.
But here we have the defendant stating looking at, and obviously, no question, people sometimes pretend they're reading for personal reasons and reasons of embarrassment, but you have him looking down and appearing in the video to be reading, and certainly that's the finding of the trial court, and then you have him saying, I understand. So what is it that additional questioning is going to reveal? And I understand there are people out there who are going to be concealing this for difficult, because of a difficult situation they have in their own life. But what is the additional question that's going to break through that recalcitrance on the part of the individual that is not asked here?
See, I don't think it's the recalcitrance that we are particularly worried about. I think for purposes of the hearing, it's what proof is being offered that, in fact, that the person was provided that it's knowing, intelligent, voluntary. I think that the focus is not so much at that point. Remember, we're talking about the hearing itself, the 104 hearing. If that information is provided to the court, the court can make that kind of a reasonable finding that, in fact, that this information was read to the person, that the information is out there. We don't even know right now whether or not, based on the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt those, you know, the knowing, knowledge, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. We have no idea from this record that, in fact, that happened. And that
what happened?
That he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived those rights. The fact that he continues to talk is not in and of itself an indication of his understanding of waiver.
And you're telling us when he says, yes, he understands, we need to go beyond that.
Yes.
And say he may be stating an untruth there. I'm not saying in any negative way, but he may be stating an untruth. So what is the magic additional step that is going to resolve that issue?
Okay. Two answers. One, the explicit necessity of that information being imparted to a defendant, whether it's to an English-speaking, Spanish-speaking. And in the context, it becomes, I think, again, the record here is the importance of the Spanish-speaking individual, that they are less likely, because not only do you have the not issue of literacy, but you have the issue of understanding. But I'm focused more so, Judge, on what information sustains the burden of proof with regard to proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
I understand what you're talking about with the hearing, but it all comes back to what's asked. The hearing, the evidence is presented to the trial court.
Right.
But what you are, I think, telling us that we should be doing, and I agree with the comment of Justice Fernandez-Vina that it is not limited to Spanish speakers. If there is an additional substantive information that should be provided to a defendant, you're telling us there must be more. And what I'm asking is, knowing that there will be people who, for reasons of embarrassment or anything else, will just say, I understand, I understand, I understand, and not acknowledge that they're having difficulty either with the vocabulary, with the concept, with the language, with a poor translation, whatever it may be, what is it that's going to break through that impasse, if that's so, that we should be requiring?
I think by a clear waiver, which doesn't exist in this case. And again, I'm arguing with this record.
I think what the judge wants to know is what constitutes a clear waiver in your process. Because if you read it to someone, they're not listening, maybe they don't understand. If they read it, maybe they don't know how to read, they don't want to tell you. Maybe they were answering yes to something else. What is it that saying, do you now understand these rights? They might lie about that and say, yeah, I understood them. I have no idea what you're talking about. So what is it in your mind, what step, what magic word is there or process that ensures that not only they understood what they read or was read to them, but they are waiving? What magic word is there or process?
Maybe the chief's question of, do you understand? Simply ask you, do you understand what we just read to you?
How about if they're shy and say, yeah, I understood, and they didn't? How are we ever going to know?
We may not know, but the finder of fact, who has to make the conclusion as to its admissibility, will have information within the record that allows him to draw that inference.
Isn't the totality of circumstance analysis better than one magic question?
Well, you just still have the totality of circumstances where the majority talks about they didn't ask his education, they didn't ask whether he was literate, they didn't even ask whether or not there's certain language, something to indicate waiver,
Do you understand the question that the officer posed? Are you suggesting that that was... We understand that it wasn't as clear as you would have liked. Are you suggesting it didn't relate to the question of the administration of the rights?
It may have to do with the administration of the rights, but the issue then becomes, do you waive?
It's not about the cell phone. Your position is it's just an insufficiently clear question about waiver.
It's too ambiguous. And again, if you have the fact finder doesn't have the information on which it can rely. And that's really what I think the appellate division was dealing with here, is that there was insufficient information to rely on that finding. And OPS, by the way, there's burden shifting with regard to it.
Any other questions?
If there are no further questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Shalom.
Be brief. May it please the court. During the Tillery argument, there was some conversation about implied waivers. And it kind of came up that perhaps what should happen is if the suspect continues to speak after being advised of the right but having not formally waived, there'd be some clarification. If you keep talking, I'm going to understand that to be a waiver. And Justice Fernandez-Vina, you asked, well, what if they just keep talking? What do we do then? And the answer given at the time was, well, that might not be enough. I think that's wrong. I think that would certainly be enough. But let's be very clear here. We're not talking about the rare instance where a defendant insists on spilling the beans prior to having gone through the formalities. What my friends from the state are proposing is that they can do away with the waiver altogether, that it is surplusage in the Miranda warnings. And that is, I think, both counter to Burgess, which Burgess says that a defendant understanding his or her rights, a suspect understanding his or her rights, is necessary but not sufficient. There was some talk about framing it, not using the word waiver, but saying understanding these rights or having heard these rights, do you now wish to speak with me? That wasn't done here. And the burden is really what I think this case is about, that there are these necessary pieces of information that are simply omitted. And the state says, but we must defer to the factual findings of the judge. But SS is guidance, not a straitjacket. SS doesn't shield trial courts from judicial review. And so here there are these two critical questions necessary to shoulder the state's burden, which are factual findings. One is, he would have spoken up if only, if he didn't understand. And I think that there's the burden shifting problem with that, which the court has already addressed. And there's the fact that it is belied by the record. Justice Patterson, you are totally correct that it is something very different if they say, did you do a certain act? And you say, no, I didn't do that. Denying the act is not the same as clarifying comprehension. I think almost any defendant would speak up if the officer were putting words in his mouth, but that's not the same as saying, I don't understand. And the other critical piece is that there's this factual finding that he read, that he actually read to himself that piece, and that is simply not a fact. It's not just that it's wrong, it's that it cannot be made.
Well, I have a question about that. Is the ACLU asking us to assume that there's a problem with literacy when we're dealing with a Hispanic defendant?
It has nothing to do with the fact that this is a Spanish-speaking defendant. It has everything to do with the fact that the state failed to read a provision that is required for English speakers, Spanish speakers, or Mandarin speakers.
So
everyone should get the waiver.
Your argument is we have to ask the education level of every individual who is given rights.
No, Justice Levesque. The only way you have to get to the education level is if you rely on the suspect to read the language to him or herself. If you do one of two other things, either the police officer reads it or you ask the suspect to read it aloud, then you don't need to ask educational
level. That doesn't fit with the rest of your argument. The rest of your argument is simply hearing it doesn't necessarily convey understanding.
Well, but certainly him reading it aloud suggests that he couldn't make an argument that he was illiterate if he had read it aloud. I think that's a fair point to make, and that is a standard practice.
But it doesn't go to your question, your argument, and your colleague's argument about understanding the meaning and significance of the waiver.
Understood. And so Justice Fernandez-Vina was also asking about this when Mr. Neary was up. And I think the answer is, if you have a case where it is read to him, he says, yes, I understand it, and then proceeds. And then you can look at the rest of the interrogation to say, does this seem like he understood it? My friend from the Attorney General's office talked about someone who was speaking nonsense, right, responding about a fish market rather than biographical questions, that would undermine it. But other than that, if he said, yes, I understand, and there's not later indicia of a lack of understanding, that would be sufficient. That has always been sufficient.
So going back to my first question, you then have a problem any time the state asks an individual, whether they're Spanish-speaking, English-speaking, Mandarin-speaking, to read to themselves language that is not asked to be read back out loud.
Correct. In the context of a waiver of critically important constitutional rights.
Understand.
We do. And here's the thing. This court asked the Attorney General to standardize forms in Mejia, and the Attorney General has chosen, for reasons that baffle me, not to. And so it's not the case that you're going to mandate a form, but let's be very clear. If you say we're going to skip this step of waiver in this case, mm-hmm. then waiver's gone.
Is it your position?
Then that's going to be off of all of the forms.
Is it your position, basically, just because you can't prove everything doesn't mean you shouldn't prove something? So reading something, having the defendant read it aloud or having read, it's not perfect. It's not going to solve everything, but it may meet some minimal threshold level.
That's exactly right, Justice Albin. I was sitting at counsel table thinking, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It's true, we won't have absolute certitude, but if we're trying to get to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, there are certain steps that the state should be taking in every case. And look, again, that doesn't mean they might not forget or do something that varies in some case, and then it's up to the court to decide, well, is it sufficient? But if we don't have, if the form can omit the waiver, and both the prosecutor and the Attorney General took the position that it was unnecessary, the waiver language needn't be read at all. If that's the case, I suspect we're going to start seeing many more cases where the waiver language isn't read at all.
Maybe not. We've also heard Bergen County come forward and say they've now instructed their officers, you should do it.
In response to a reversal of an aggravated sexual assault case by the appellate division, which is now on appeal.
And I understand your argument to be a plea that the court not write an opinion that says you can eliminate the acknowledgement of rights / waiver section of the form. Is that fair?
It goes a little further than that, Chief Justice, which is to say this is a critical part of the form. And not that please don't do it, we'd like to generally see it, but that if we want someone to waive, they must A, be advised of each of the rights, and B, waive them. And I don't think it's not talismanic, it's not magic words, but there is something more. Because theoretically, under the state's construction, a person who clearly could read, a PhD candidate, could be given a form with the Miranda warnings, said, read them, and then they go ahead and just start asking questions. And that's not, I think, what Miranda demands. And it's interesting. We all know that Miranda has changed a lot. The Miranda line of cases at the United States Supreme Court has evolved, Burgess being one example. But the state talks about, the Attorney General spoke about the fact that the idea that you could terminate at any point isn't actually part of the Miranda warnings. So there's a question, are we relying on exactly what Miranda said? Because if we are, Miranda is very clear that you need the warnings and a formal waiver, or are we looking at how it's evolved? And either way, you need both warnings and waiver.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Moore.
Your Honors, the Office of the Public Defender is happy to join the prior two arguments with respect to the waiver section, and I want to dedicate my time to the issue of the need for qualified interpreters. Your Honors, a confession is one of the most compelling pieces of evidence that a jury can have put before them. For that reason, this court and the justice system has to do everything in its power to make sure that piece of evidence is reliable. When a suspect is assigned an unqualified police officer to act as his interpreter, we simply can't do that.
But that's going to inure to the detriment of the state. I mean, so if there is a colloquy by a completely unqualified translator, the state isn't going to be able to elicit an intelligent interview, which you'll be able to challenge at the 104 hearing.
I would agree, Your Honor, if we were just...
Go ahead.
Sorry. If we were just talking about a completely unqualified interpreter, but I think that the interpretation of Officer Ramos in this case tells us what we should actually be worried about. Officer Ramos talked about how he grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, just as about 16% of New Jerseyans do, and that he felt comfortable translating, and usually he did that all right. But not always. And so I'm looking at page 15 of the transcript here.
But I know you're about to read this, but the point is, at the 104 hearing, all of Ramos's errors were exposed. And that is the purpose of the adversarial hearing. So the fact that Ramos may not have been a good translator was fully exposed and understood by the court. And there was the opportunity to get a completely qualified translation, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And what the court found was the right solution to that was to simply take out everything that Ramos did wrong. So those are the paraphrasings, the incorrect translations, all of that. And what that means is that the inevitable conclusion would have been that the jury was put in a position where they were only getting part of the story. If this were an English speaker and an English speaker, they'd be getting the whole story. If this were a Spanish speaker and a qualified Spanish speaker, they'd be getting the whole story. But the same isn't true in this sort of situation, where the judge is put in a position where he can rip the entire center of the interrogation out and then say that's good enough for the jury. Or what this court can do is put a prophylactic in place to make sure that when we're creating evidence, that evidence is better.
So is this a due process problem that you're identifying, or is it, as the questions just posed suggest, an issue where the state may suffer from its own mistake of taking someone who's not as qualified as they should be?
I think it's partially a due process problem, Your Honor. Because an individual who is taken into custody and is interrogated in a language other than English, and this is maybe more of an equal protection problem, is going to be treated fundamentally differently and have fewer opportunities than an individual who is interrogated in English or by a certified interpreter. And we can see that here. For example, opposing counsel and my friends on the other side have said that the defendant in this case had the opportunity to push back and to correct things that were said wrongly. And that's an opportunity that every English-speaking defendant is going to have. But frankly, the characterization that he had that opportunity isn't true here, partially because some of the information wasn't relayed to him, and some of the information that he said out loud wasn't relayed to the interrogating officer. I'm thinking, for example, of on page 25 to 26, when the defendant said, that's when I touched her chest and I touched her bottom part also. And what Officer Ramos translated is, that's when he grabbed her breast and touched her vagina. And so, in that case, if we were in an English-speaking interrogation, and someone said, and I said, I touched them, and the officer said, okay, you grabbed them, I would say, no, that's absolutely not what happened. And the jury would see that. And that sort of correction, how often do we see defense counsel at trial stand up and say, you saw that my client insisted 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times that that's not what happened.
But did the jury hear Ramos's interpretation?
The jury wouldn't have heard Ramos's interpretation, Your Honor, but the point is
that what requests had been made by defense counsel to play for the sake of, the doctrine of completeness.
Exactly, Your Honor.
I'm sure the judge would have allowed it, so.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So
but
what couldn't counsel have made that, Your Honor, under the doctrine of completeness, I request that the entire interrogation be played so the jury can get the flavor for the mistakes that were made in the interrogation. Why couldn't that have been done? And wouldn't that be better for you, actually?
It wouldn't, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. Because that puts the defendant in a position where they either, for the sake of completeness, need to be offering this into evidence, but then be offering in inflammatory statements, like he grabbed her breast and touched her vagina.
No, you would be arguing is, look at the state's detective. He's trying to completely make a case that wasn't there, completely misinterpreting what he said. Now you... Isn't it evident they were out to get him? I mean, there are plenty of things that a defense attorney would be able to do with that information, no?
I think there could be, Your Honor, but I think that having a battle of the experts where the defendant has to hire their own interpreter to come in and tell the jury, actually, this word was translated wrong, whereas the police officer comes in and swears.
Do you trust the translation of the state, the public defender's office, or when there's a confession, do you have one of your own experts look over to make certain that it's correct, particularly given the percentage of error that we've been
We do,
told
Your
about.
Honor. Of course, we're going to have an expert look it over, but the difference
is... Call
that
expert as a witness?
Sometimes, Your Honor, if there's a problem. The difference is, Your Honor, that we're going to be put in a position where there are a lot more problems to correct after the fact, and this court can easily obviate those problems in the first place by putting in place a prophylactic rule. But I want to be clear.
You're asking us for a rule, just so I understand, that would apply to the trial phase as well. This case, of course, was a plea.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was the defendant prejudiced by the quality of the translation as relates to the suppression motion itself?
I think so, Your Honor, and this, I think, is the second part of the answer to Justice Fernandez-Vina's point, which is that once we're at the position of being in the court and hashing out line by line what a correct translation of what was said in the room is, the damage has already been done because something different was said in the room than what would have been said if there were a good interrogation.
What damage is there, though? You have a video. You have the record preserved. And if there is an error, as was occurred here, I think you have a very strong argument if this interrogation took place on a park bench unrecorded and Officer Ramos were in testifying Neri's client said certain things. That becomes a credibility issue, but you have the videotape. And you can bring in your translators who can say that was an absolute mistranslation of what he said there, did occur in this case. So what is the danger out there given the rule that, you know, in almost all cases you're going to be looking at either a video or at least an audio?
I have two answers to your question, Justice Patterson. The first is I think there's a fundamental difference between allowing the state without adducing the evidence to support the accuracy of its translation and that it's competent evidence, as the rules of evidence require. To simply let that in and then have the defendant fight back against it is, I think, a misapplication of the rules of evidence and is going to be less effective.
I'm not saying let it into evidence. A 104 hearing, it's not being let in. It's being debated between the two parties for purposes of determining admissibility. So I would agree with you. You don't just let it in and, you know, fight it out. But there's a stage where the court can absolutely say this doesn't come in.
Yeah, well, I think that would be true if we were talking about wildly different translations. So, for example, if the defendant had said, I didn't touch her, and the officer said, he says he touched her, then easy. 104 hearing takes care of that. Conversely, in an iteration of a transcript where there's an only slightly incorrect translation, so touch versus grab, the 104 hearing isn't necessarily going to knock that out. And this brings me to the second answer to your question, which is by the time we're looking at a cold, cut and dry transcript, the problems have already occurred. And so in the room, an individual, as borne out by the expert studies that are cited in our briefs, an individual who's a certified interpreter is going to stop and ask a question and say, did you mean touched or did you mean grabbed? And they're going to elucidate that at the time. And that'll let the defendant say, no, I never grabbed her. And so what I mean to say by that is that the actual tape that we're producing to be translated later is going to be different for a defendant who is speaking through an unqualified interpreter than it would be for a defendant who were speaking to someone in his own language or through a qualified neutral interpreter. And I want to be clear, Your
Honor. I'm sorry, but in both cases, the defendant is saying what the defendant is saying in his own language.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it can be verified what that means, even in the case of a dialect. It can be verified what that means to the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor, but the defendant is deprived of the opportunity in the room to explain himself. So if there's a piece of confusion, the officer is running very little risk by getting on the stand and explaining what he thought was happening and why he thinks his interpretation is correct. Conversely, the defendant is put in a position where he's not given the opportunity in the room to clarify what he meant and to deny false allegations. And so he's instead put in a position where does he have to take the stand and say, no, that's not what I said in cases of ambiguity? That's making the defendant choose between one right and another, and that's not the business that this court should be in. The second point, Your Honor, is that I want to be clear that we've talked about the difference between speakers of Spanish, for example, or other common languages. 2% of New Jerseyans speak different dialects of Chinese at home. Those individuals might be put in the spot, like the defendant in this case, where they go down to the station and there's somebody there who spoke Spanish at home and is going to do sort of a slipshod, cobbled together interrogation. But if I went into the station house and I only spoke, say, Polish, Arabic, Farsi, something like that, then I would get that qualified interpreter. The state could use a language line, they could use a translator that they had a retainer with, something like that. And so I would get that qualified translator. By having the rule in place as it is and letting uncertified policemen perform as not the interrogator but as the interpreter, we're treating Spanish-speaking defendants differently than English-speaking defendants and differently than defendants who speak other slightly less common languages. And given the changing face of New Jersey, that sort of disparate impact isn't something that this court should be condoning. And that's why a rule requiring a certified, competent interpreter best serves the interests of justice. And as this court recognized in Henderson, sometimes that means waiting outside the four corners of the courtroom, or I guess more than four, and going into the interrogation room to make sure not that we can catch bad evidence after the fact, but that the evidence created in the first instance is going to be reliable, is going to be better. It means there will be fewer false confessions, and basically it's the convergence of this court's justice-seeking and truth-seeking duty with the interest of treating New Jersey's most vulnerable citizens equally, putting them on the same playing field.
Thank you, Ms. Moore.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Kennedy, rebuttal.
I'm very mindful of Your Honor's time. I just want to make a few points. Just with response more to the translation issue, I just want to make, as I illustrated in my presentation, accuracy is never guaranteed. So whether it's going to be a police officer translating or an independent translator, who we, by the way, would be paying in this scenario, I question whether it's independent, but whether it's that person or a police officer, there's always going to be concerns of, you know, something was perhaps mistranslated. So there's no silver bullet here. And there's absolutely, and Justice Alvin, Your Honor's question was great, there's absolutely no incentives for the police officer serving as a translator to mistranslate. If the suspect says, I saw the victim, and the officer translated as, he said he shot the victim, then the person doing the interrogation is like, oh, he said he shot the victim. It's case closed, we're done. You know, you want the person serving as a translator to accurately translate exactly what the defendant or the suspect is saying, because that is the best way to get the best evidence. So there's zero incentive for any officer to mistranslate anything in the context of this of a police interrogation.
Among other sanctions, could a judge bar a transcript if the judge thought that it was riddled with errors?
Yes, and I think, Your Honor, it would be similar to the driver analysis where there's issues with a recording, and there ultimately the judge has to make a determination under 403 whether sort of the problem with the recording is so bad that it infected the entire proceeding, or whether, you know, they can use their discretion to ensure fairness. So I think the driver analysis could equally apply here, and I think that's what the judge did, and I think it was a very elegant solution, was to say that any editorializing mistranslation would not be presented. So you would actually hear defendant's actual words, you would actually hear the questions that were being asked to him, and you cut out the translation from the detective. And obviously, if the defendant wanted to explore that, the rule of completeness would probably permit it. It would be basically the defendant's option.
Took you off track. You were on a roll.
Yeah. So, and I just want to make clear in this case, so we talked, there was a lot made about this earlier discussion of I touched the top and I touched the bottom also, was translated into I touched her breast, or I grabbed her breast, and touched her vagina. So the officer did mistranslate that. But let's be clear. Later in this interview, the defendant physically demonstrated how he touched his 14-year-old granddaughter on the vagina and on her breast. Physically demonstrated. There was absolutely no mistranslation. He didn't do it because something was mistranslated. He showed the detective what he did, which was illegal in this case. And he also admitted without any mistranslation that he was erect. So there was this earlier circumstance. When you view the record as a whole, I don't think there's any doubt that he made those admissions, those physical admissions, for any other reason than because he was telling the officer that he, in fact, did what he was accused of by his 14-year-old granddaughter. And the other point I want to make, and this is to this is my last point. This is to the waiver argument, and there's discussion about whether the defendant was active before the Miranda warnings or after the Miranda warnings. First of all, I think whether he's active before or after, I could see why your courts want to identify that. I think even if he's active after, in sort of explain or alleging that stating that he misunderstands something, that is indicative of what he would have said before, like during the Miranda colloquy. And as I said, there are six instances, and I stopped counting later in the interview, where defendant was asked a question. It wasn't just I didn't do this. He was asked a question in English and he didn't understand it. So he looked at the detective for the translation, and that's at DA 125, DA 137, DA 138, DA 140, DA 148. Those are all instances where he indicates he did not understand the question in English, and he looked at the translator to translate it for him. So he was capable of saying it. And I think during the Miranda colloquy at the beginning, there also is two instances where he's very active in asserting that he doesn't understand something. And I think this was an important point, and I don't want this to get lost in the record. And that's at DA 122. And Detective Lucas is asking him, and he says, all right, what I have here is your Miranda rights. Do you understand what those are? This is like the initial preliminary thing. And the transcript says, But when you look at watch the video, it's that he says but on the video he shakes his head no, and that's at, I can give you the timestamp, 16:59:18. He shakes his head no. So he was able to tell them during the Miranda colloquy that initially I've never been given Miranda. I'm not familiar with my Miranda rights. So he was capable of saying it at the top of the interview, and then on that same page, DA 122, it's at two exchanges down. The question is, okay, this form I have one of these in English, but you have said you're most comfortable in Spanish. So, and he interrupts the detective, this is Detective Lucas, and says, in Spanish. So again, he's being active and saying, don't give me the English form, give me the Spanish form. So I think, you know, those...
I think we've got it.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We're in recess till 3 o'clock.